The next thing I know, you know, we got a fleet of boats and crews and people all over the world doing cannabis business. And so it started with humble beginnings and ended in a fairly massive scale.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields, and with me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, kingpin and founder of Gentleman Smugglers, Barry Foy. Barry, thanks for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Good, man. It's really, it's going to be fun to talk with you guys. I've listened to some of y'all's podcasts. Y'all kind of dive deep, and that's what it takes to learn about this business. You know, it's a very complicated one. So, yeah, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, excited to dive in, especially with your story and its long heritage. Kellen, how are you doing?
Doing really, really well. Excited to talk to Barry. Excited to talk about East Coast cannabis back in the day and today as well. Yeah, I'm just excited, Brian. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm glad, Kellen, we got right to it. Yes, Barry has origins on the East Coast and is currently on the East Coast. So Barry, quickly, East Coast, West Coast, if you had to choose a coast, which one are you choosing?
Well, you know, we looked at the West Coast from, you know, of course, we're talking about the white market. And we looked at California, a little crowded, a lot of competition, a very kind of a mixed up market, so to speak. I looked at Colorado, another busy market. And so we kind of like we're East Coast right now. We do have a possible deal going out in New Mexico, of all places. With some folks in Roswell, which is right down the Alien Alley. And so it's an interesting place there as well, but that hasn't been completed yet. We hadn't put the ink to paper, but it's very close. But we love Mass. And, you know, Mass has been, it's not a new market. It doesn't have the roots that California and Colorado have as far as the longevity in the market yet. So it was a place that we thought about long and hard. Like I said, we looked at other states, but I'm an East Coast man right now.
Love it. Love it. So Barry, typically when we dive in, I ask the guests to describe how they got into the cannabis industry and if there was any hesitations, but given your unique history and experience, I'd prefer we do it a little differently. With one sentence, can you describe the Gentleman Smugglers, how big the organization was and kind of the goal or how it started?
Well, you know, it started in the early 70s, and the goal was just to kind of get the plant to folks that were in need. You know, I kind of started out selling to a lot of GIs that were shipping out to Vietnam back in the early 70s. And that's kind of how I got my start. And one thing led to another as far as, you know, how that evolved into tons and tons of cannabis. It started out with very simple roots, but grew as kind of people's attitude changed as the 70s, you know, was a kind of a cultural revolution of sorts, 60s and 70s. And the people loved cannabis. And so it was kind of a natural fit for me. My background early on with dealing with people on a small level. I love working with people that I've worked with over the years. And so it's been fun. It was really a very simple way that I got into it. And I just kept the ball rolling. And it's like climbing that ladder, you know, one rung after another. And the next thing I know, you know, we got a fleet of boats and crews and people all over the world doing cannabis business. And so it started with humble beginnings and ended in a fairly massive scale.
Can you give some context when you say massive scale, just for our listeners?
Well, the government, you know, says that we were, you know, up there around 200 tons of cannabis and maybe 50 or 60 or 70 tons of hashish from Lebanon. So we were kind of, I would say, global in the end, for sure, before the feds finally caught up with us. But massive amounts, tractor-trailer loads, you know, large ship loads. And so it was fairly big, but it also was, to me, as I look back, a reminder of it was always, we never had enough. It's not like today, like it's very competitive in the legal world. We never had enough. People are always going, well, when's the next trip? When's the next load? When are we going to be there again? Or we had a lot of workers. We had hundreds of people that work for us. And so there was always that constant need for more inventory. Very, very thirsty crowd out there. And so that kind of kept us going as well. And it was exciting, you know. I mean, when you got four or five federal agencies chasing, you know, and they're trying to catch you and you're trying to stay ahead of them. And it's that back and forth cat and mouse game. It starts to become like, well, this is like an adventure, man. This is more than a business. This is fun. And people love it, you know, and we're making people feel better, even though they didn't know about it as much back then, about what the different strains do for you and the different, how different terpenes affect you and cannabinoids help ease certain ailments. We knew it, but we didn't know it. You know, we didn't have what little research so far we have tells us what a great plant that cannabis is. So subconsciously, I think we knew it. And so it was always a high demand. It was never enough. It's a very different situation that is today in the competitive cannabis world, the legal world. No regulations back then. We were the sheriff, you know. we made our own rules. We were our own dispensaries. We transported. We had nobody tell us how, when, and where to do it. We didn't have any fucking stickers that we had to put on things and mark everything and security guards to get in here and let me see your ID. You know, 20 times before you can make a single purchase. So it was relatively easy if you want to look at and compare the two, and what it was like. It was a lot more fun. I'll say that in a sense that it was, you know, it was daring. It was, you're breaking the rules. It's different than today. Today is very regulatory, follow the rules. So it's a little something of an adjustment for me.
How has your personal relationship evolved with the plant since the 70s to nowadays?
Well, I mean, I guess my own personal relationship, I was a user very early on, and I'm still a user today. Today's strains are much stronger than they were in the 70s and 80s. We've come a long way with developing and crossing strains, and it seems like every few weeks I turn around and somebody else has got a higher THC count. You know, oh no, we've hit 40 or we've hit the high 30s, and it seems to be just something that's, you know, when's it gonna stop? Probably never. But the products today are much stronger. They definitely last longer. And so I think we've come a long way in that situation as far as doing research but I'm more of a nighttime toker, so to speak. It's later on in the evening when I don't like to smoke too much in the daytime anymore. I like to get good sleep. And so if I sleep, if I partake at night after maybe having some dinner, I know I'm going to sleep well. Cause at my age, that's really important. You know, give me some rest, dude. You know, I've burnt both ends of the candles for a long time. It's time for me to kind of, you know, be able to get my good rest every night, 8 or 9 hours of sleep. So I use cannabis mainly for that, just for that reason, and it works great.
Just kind of going back to the story, how did you develop the trust with the suppliers, especially internationally, knowing there has to be a level of, here I am, this is my intention, and them kind of being the middle ground? Because there has to be some sort of handshake understanding between the two parties and saying, like, this is my intention, and if this goes well, I'll continue to come back. Is that kind of the origin of that? And give us some of the specifics of how that originally formed.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, you have to have trust. And along with that trust, you know, it's both entities want to be able to make money in the end. Of course, we want to share the cannabis people want to enjoy, but we wouldn't be doing this today in the white market, and we definitely didn't do it back in the day in the black market without having the end results of making some money. That's just the way it is in this capitalistic society that we live in. And so on the other end, the people in Colombia or Jamaica or Lebanon, they knew that if we were successful and they did their part of the deal, then they were going to be successful as well. And so it was a money kind of was a binding part of the whole transaction, as well as getting to know the people you were working with and the people that were supplying us from different parts of the world. we became tight. You know, we had to be. We were transferring, you know, millions of dollars from one place to another. We were handling a lot of money, exchanging a lot of money quite a bit. And so there was an amount of trust that was built as well. So I was lucky in that aspect. I don't have really any bad experiences with my connections back in the day. It was really, it was very smooth. I was very particular. And I've always been particular about who I associated with. So it was natural that we vetted these people fairly closely. And so, but we had great relationships, especially people out of Colombia and Jamaica. Lebanon was a little bit of a different story. But I've been fortunate. And it's actually rolled over into today's world with us here in Massachusetts right now, that I've found that people really accept the legacy market and our story. We have a unique story. Our brand is, you know, built on adventure, built on past being in the past cannabis business and having a history of being there early. A lot of folks don't know how we got where we are today in the legal world. We didn't get there without a lot of suffering. People still in prison today for the plant. That's something we can touch on later if you like. But I was very fortunate in my connections. And that's kind of, I don't know if you want to call it luck or preparation meeting opportunity. But there were quite a few like-minded people back in the day, as there still is in the black market, as we have out in the West Coast, as we all know. California really took over the smuggling aspect. When the feds cracked down on smuggling pot, back in the pretty much smuggling pot, pretty much as I knew it, ended up later in the 80s. And when that happened, I think California kind of took over gradually that role of producing and becoming a mass producer, because smuggling was kind of over. I mean, every now and then, you'll hear about somebody doing something crazy, but nothing like back in the day. So I'm glad we're at the point we're at today, because we also need to expose the government's role in all this, you know, where we're at today with people still being in jail. It's kind of difficult for me to imagine, say, somebody is in jail in New York State where it's legal now, and they're in jail for the plant. It happens all over. It's really kind of, it's troubling.
The reason I asked about trust specifically was because obviously in your past, trust was a paramount factor in developing those relationships. And as you've progressed to the legal market, that same kind of being able to read the individual that you're associating with is so critical, because when an end consumer goes to reach for your brand, there is a trust behind the name behind that. So kind of expanding on that, assessing risk early on, is there certain opportunities where you passed on certain suppliers or certain countries because you felt internally it wasn't good for us, or you thought there was too many opportunities for failure points?
You know, that's a kind of a question I never had run by myself to think about, because my connections were always pretty rock solid. Again, I was very fortunate how that went down the pike there, and I felt very, very lucky. I think it's for me, it's more difficult to navigate the regulatory world I live in today than it was to navigate with partners back in the smuggling days. It's much more tricky. It's much more complicated. And so I would love to have some of my old partners or my suppliers back in the day be up here somewhere in Mass or New York, or, you know, that I could deal with them, because it's different, and everything about the cannabis business is an emerging situation. And now some of your other viewers have expressed the same. There is no Bible. There's nothing written to follow this path to success. It's very complicated. So I was always lucky in my connections, and people love, especially up in Mass, the people I work with love the story. They love what we bring. And so I've been very fortunate and blessed in that area.
So earlier you mentioned that in the early days, it wasn't an issue of supply because everyone is always looking for more.
Yeah,
I think it might be a little different nowadays. So how challenging is it looking back in the 70s versus now in terms of managing your supply and your supply chain and all of those aspects? Right? There's more material, but is it still all like the same high quality material?
Well, I think, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there weren't really any strains. There were maybe four or five. And that was it. You'd have Colombian Gold or Santa Marta Gold. You'd have Lamb's Bread from Jamaica. You'd have, you know, Lebanese Hash. You would maybe have some Mexican Bricks and some Panama Red, Thai Sticks maybe, but just a handful of strains and names, so to speak. A strain every minute in my mind. So it's much more complicated today with sorting, sampling, figuring out the product that you're going to put on the shelf, that you're going to entrust, that people entrust to me to make sure that it's right. It's definitely a little bit more, people are much more conscious about what they partake, what they want, particular strains that may be their favorites. It's a much more challenging and complicated business now than it was back then, for sure. Again, you didn't say, well, geez, I need this particular strain, or I need this particular type. I want this particular product. People were just glad to get the one strain we had, the one particular product we had. So it's much more complicated pricing. Remember, back in the day, the competition, there was very little. As soon as a load came in, if I brought in 30,000, 40,000 pounds, I had my money in about 2 months. You know, a month and a half, I was paid up, ready to go again. And today, I mean, you know, you hear of dispensaries that have trouble paying the distributors. People are it's very, very tough. As you well know, how the prices have collapsed in some places, especially California and Colorado, and even now in Massachusetts. It's all about how that's really working. And that makes it even a tougher environment to try to stay on top of how it's changing. It's rapidly changing. So we're a brand, and being a brand, we have to even be more careful and more aware of pricing and that type of thing. So it's complicated, much more today.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get into that, because the trust aspect, and I think the authenticity behind the story is kind of what is one of the compelling aspects of the brand that your team's put together. So from 1971 to 1986, I read your team imported over 250 tons valued at over $1 billion. And at age 21, you had your first $1 million in cash. If those information is correct, what is it like as a 21-year-old having $1 million in cash?
It was eye-opening, to say the least. It was something that I guess it'd be like winning the lottery, you know, the Powerball or something. And what the hell are we going to do with all this? Fortunately, as I made money, I put a lot of my money back into the business, keep things going, which was something that, you know, I did to build on my the group I was working with and what our goals were, and the pressure that was on us to keep supply available for the people that we, you know, kind of came up with, so to speak, and that were distributors on the East Coast. We distributed, well, really from Chicago, we're mostly west of the Mississippi. We were everywhere, you know, Atlanta, Chicago, New York, New Jersey, Boston, Washington, D.C., on and on. So we had quite a bit of customers to take care of. And having that kind of money at an early age really kind of prepared me for what was to come, because that was just kind of like a drop in the bucket compared to what it was, became 10 years later, and what we were doing 10 years later. And that money was good, but it was also part of just, it wasn't something that I sat around and dwelled on, you know, gosh, we got this. It was kind of just gave me more tools in the tool chest, so to speak. Now, yes, we had a good time, and money never was an object. You know, if we wanted to jump on a jet, we'd jump on our private jet. If we had a boat we wanted to be on, we had our own boats and cars and whatnot. But I used a lot of my money to reinvest, to build the business. And so it required a lot. When you had a lot of people that were working for you, and you had a lot of a fleet of boats, et cetera, so there was quite a large amount of expenses involved.
the reason I wanted to highlight that is because even today, the cannabis industry operates with cash as the primary factor. And the challenges that you face then with having to prioritize certain relationships or certain infrastructure is still the same dilemma that most organizations face, just differently with most of the government being the biggest hurdle in the operation.
Correct. I mean, and some of that's still present today. You know, people have trouble with their, you know, in the business today of being it's still kind of basically a cash business for the most part. And that's also an added problem to in today's world. I mean, there's been a lot of situations where people are, you know, robbed or lost cash or, you know, we didn't have that problem. Again, we were fortunate. You know, we took measures to make sure that our cash was protected, but we also, like I said, early on, we vetted who we were in business with very closely. So, because again, that's something that I was hoping that I was in a dispensary, a couple of days ago, and they've said, no, we can't take cash right now. You've got to go to the ATM machine. You know the deal. So hopefully that's going to change here with when Congress gets busy and takes this seriously and we can get some laws passed to help people out today and that money, in that monetary area, borrowing money, depositing money, working with banks, just being kind of normal, you know? So we'll see where that goes. I don't have my fingers. I've got my fingers crossed. I don't really have my hopes up that anything's going to happen much this year, but we'll see.
So trust is like an integral part of any operation, especially when you're working in the legacy market or, you know, the underground market. I mean, most organizations that are successful end up kind of behaving similar to like a family, if you will. And so you talk about vetting, right? And there are probably specific characteristics that you're looking for in individuals before you kind of associate with them and start working with them. Are those same kind of vetting characteristics the exact same like rubric that you follow now when you're vetting specific operators to potentially do partnerships with or kind of hire new individuals within your brand?
Yes, a good question. No, I think that it goes forward from what I learned back in the day. And you know, a solid handshake, look me in the eyes, be transparent. We're all in this together. Don't make it any more difficult by being, you know, somebody that's, you know, on the shady side, because really you're not going to last too long. I found up here in Mass, if your reputation is not up to par, it spreads pretty quickly who and what you are. And I was amazed by it. And that most everybody is on the up and up, but like anything else, any other business, there's always going to be some shady characters running around. And hopefully we're able to sort those folks out. And I think also being that it's a complicated business, that's the communication is very important, because you know there's a lot of moving parts going on, pricing, packaging you have to always be keeping up with. The supply chain can be very shaky. Who's your supplier for your packaging? Who's your supplier for your product? Those are all really important aspects of being successful. And I think we've been very lucky in that aspect here in Mass. Like I said, people really respect the legacy that we bring, the background we come from, and how we helped everybody get to where they are today in whatever small way that was, because we weren't the only people doing it, smuggling in the 70s and 80s. There was quite a few other groups, some maybe not as big as we were, but certainly on par with us, there were other groups. So I think that, you know, it's the communication is really important too. And being able to sit down and talk to someone and look them eye to eye and look at their product, tour their facilities, and, you know, that open arm coming and look at everything we got. We don't have anything to hide. You know, this is who we are. So that's kind of what I look for when I'm talking to folks about doing business.
Let's do a quick rapid fire.
Go ahead.
True or false? You can be both a gentleman and a smuggler.
True.
Favorite purchased item, good or toy during your smuggling days?
Porsches.
One particular?
All of them.
Best weed you've ever smoked?
Blue Dream.
Product or idea that you always wanted to make happen but can never could?
That's a good question. I'm still chasing it. Old school hash.
Bigger challenge, smuggling hundreds of tons and avoiding 5 government agencies or compliance in the legal cannabis industry?
That's easy, compliance.
The most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one there. I thought that St. Bart's down in the Caribbean was always one of the most beautiful places that I'd ever been. So if you know St. Martin, St. Bart's, yeah.
Dream smoking session, 3 people dead or alive?
Jesus Christ. Well, Jimi Hendrix would be one for sure.
You don't want to put Jesus as the second one? Or
no, baby Jesus, maybe. You know. Ricky Bobby.
That's maybe. So awesome.
But no. Jimi Hendrix and Will Ferrell. That would be my favorite 2 or 3.
Is there any countries you felt like with money and your relationships you could get around anything?
The Bahamas.
True or false, in Lebanon, you paid both sides, the military and the rebels, long enough to load your boat?
That's true.
Is that easy or hard?
Well, it went through their connections that we had there. They were given the money to take care of that. And when the time came that it was time to load, then they understood that both sides were going to get money. They needed to stop to get paid. And so yeah, that just shows you what money can do.
Pretty much anything.
Yes.
Has operating in the legal cannabis market surprised you?
Is operating in the legal market surprised me?
Yeah.
It took me a while to adjust to the fact that it was actually, I could talk about it in the open. You know, it was something that it took me a while, but so the surprise was slow and a slow coming surprise. Yeah.
When someone reaches for your brand, what do you want them to expect?
Quality would be at the top of the list. And also options. I want to have some options. Like, we're now producing vape carts. We do 8s, pre-rolls. We'll have a concentrate coming out sometime in the next couple of months. I really want people to have choices, because so many people have different ways of consuming today. And that premium choices would be how I describe that.
What are there any other future states that you're looking at besides New Mexico that we spoke about earlier?
Well, we talked about New Mexico earlier. Missouri, we've looked at folks in Missouri. It's a very good state to be in from a business standpoint, but it's also very difficult to get into. That's how we've kind of found it so far. We'd love to be in New York and New Jersey when things start to kind of come together. I think they're a little bit scattered right now.
Scattered is probably the nicest way I've heard someone describe the New York market.
Very, very polite. Very polite, Barry.
It's very general.
It's thriving. It just depends on how you define thriving.
Exactly. And so I don't own a bodega there, so I can't tell you. But so, and I think Ohio just came on. They're a huge state, 12 million people. And again, New York and New Jersey. Maryland, we've looked at. They're a very successful state. There's some very good companies in Maryland that I'm extremely impressed with. They've done good numbers. They're well organized. And so we have definitely looked around. We love Florida because I'm a Southeast South Carolina guy, you know, and Florida just would be a very natural fit for us. And hopefully they'll be able to get on the ballot here this in 24, I believe it is. And so we're definitely looking at other states, and we've always wanted South Carolina to get to that point where they're legal, but God knows when that'll happen.
Is one of the benefits of Florida the ability to sail 10 days to Jamaica?
That was what made Florida a good jumping off point back in the day, for sure. It was, and that 10 days, that was because that was such a small boat. That was when I was actually on the boats myself. that was a hell of a trip. So yeah, later on we had boats that were much faster than that 10-day trip. But Florida is a great state. They're number two medical state in the country, as y'all probably know. And so I think it'll be a huge rec state. All the tourists that go there, it's a natural place to consume. It's beautiful weather and so forth. So I'm looking forward to Florida as well. I would like to be in every state as a brand. I think I should be in every state. I think that it's a possibility that in 24, we'll be in two or three more states as well with Gentleman Smuggler. So it's exciting what's happening. And again, it's very challenging, and you can pull a lot of hair out trying to keep things going. And right now, the way things are. So I don't have to tell y'all hear the stories every day.
Are there any aspirations for bringing in some of your older suppliers or older vendors and relationships to having one of those connected global cannabis trades?
Well, you know, I would say that, you know, Colombia is an exporter. They export quite a bit over to Europe as we speak. I'd like to be also in some kind of global market myself. I know several people that are in the global market, and we've had some discussions. I think that's something that could happen down the road. I think that cannabis has got so many opportunities. As soon as we can get all the bullshit out of the way and be able to operate as a normal business with all the things that come in this country with operating as a normal business. As you well know, we're not operating in that right now. We're actually being hampered and restrained. And so it makes it difficult. But I think globally that we'll be there one day. And I'm hoping that Gentleman Smugglers will be there as well. I mean, we've been there before. And so we'd like to be back again for sure.
Who had better cannabis back in the day, Jamaica or Colombia?
That's another good question. I don't really want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Of course not. Everyone has a favorite.
Exactly. I think there are different qualities that when we were back in the day, we always had Colombian gold or Santa Marta gold that was grown in the Sierra Nevadas there in Colombia. Jamaica also has a mountainous area as well, not near as big as Colombia, but there are different strains that come out of those two countries. Back then, it was only really two. And so, you know, it would be a toss-up to me.
Okay.
That's funny for me to answer that question.
That was a good way of answering it.
No hurt feelings.
No. I might hear about that later.
The best one was the best one was the best price.
The best one was the best price and what we had at the time. Yes.
Amen. So,
exactly. I still occasionally somebody has some Jamaican lamb's bread that I'll be lucky enough to partake in. And you can also even today get Colombian gold seeds. And some people do carry it occasionally. And we thought about actually incorporating possibly some old school strains like that down the road with Gentleman Smugglers. So we'll have to just wait and see how that develops. But it's something we would like to do.
Looking back on your journey, is there one event or story that even you, thinking back on it, laughs and just can't believe that actually happened?
Usually it would involve some type of with me that would be back in the smuggling days would be to escape, to almost be caught and like they're right there on me. And then all of a sudden I'm able to, you know, slide away. And it happened so many times. It actually boiled down to somebody giving the feds the name that I was using currently as an alias that they were able to run me down. But it was many times that I got away on the Canadian border. They had me. I asked them where the restroom was. They let me go outside. The restroom was outside. And I looked out and they were going through the car I was in. They were searching it. And I said, I got to leave. And so I exited out the bathroom door, out into the farmland, out into the cow pastures. And here they come chasing me. With dogs, little motorbikes. It was out in the country. It was up in the Canadian-New York border. And so that was a couple of days I spent eluding them, and I was finally able to make my way back into New York by foot, sleeping, you know, it was like naked and afraid. You know, I was out there eating caterpillars and sleeping on leaves. to you know, elude the authorities again. So there was quite a few stories like that that I always, you know, hark back on and resonate with me. That was the true adventure, when you could beat the man, you know, and he's still looking for you. And he still doesn't know where you are. And everybody's getting fired because they had their hands on me and they let me go, you know. And so those are the stories that I love to talk about and expound on. And those are the exciting ones, like Catch Me If You Can, you know. Here we go again. I got work to do, guys. Y'all can't put your hands on me.
What's the most expensive lesson you've ever learned?
Getting caught. I mean, without a doubt. First, it cut my supply off money, cannabis, and then also here come the lawyers. They line up. They like your money.
Oh, yeah.
They can make a lot of promises to you, you know. So that was probably the biggest loss ever, that one day. So, but I'm back, you know, and Gentlemen Smugglers, we're back. We're here to stay. We're going to make this happen. We'll figure it out. It's a daily, thing to stay on top of it and try to be successful. I don't have to tell y'all, if you look back at cannabis stocks of the major holders of stocks, and we know the big companies, they haven't fared well. And it's indicative of the business right now that it's in a flux. And I appreciate what y'all do to kind of bring this to the forefront so we all together can figure this out, you know, because we're in it together. We've been in it together, even back in the days before y'all even around or even a thought, you know, the 70s and 80s, we were still figuring it out. And we're going to figure it out till we get it right. And we're just operating as normal businesses like we should be, and not being constrained and regulated to death. I think they took the regulations off of us and made us like a normal companies do operate. It would really change the business.
If you could put anything on a billboard, metaphorically speaking, to get a message to billions of people, could be an image, quote, word, or something that inspired you, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Free all the cannabis prisoners right now. Give Gentlemen Smugglers the key. And I'd have a key on that billboard, be one of those old looking jailhouse keys to unlock that big door. And that would be my job, to unlock the door and let all cannabis prisoners out today. Perfectly that would said. Be what I would have on the billboard.
Perfectly said. All right. Prediction time. Barry, given your experience with cannabis around the world, where do you think will be a major hotspot in the next 15 years?
I think Europe will be huge, in my opinion. If you're talking about locations and cannabis business, I would say Europe is on the cusp of becoming huge, as well as South America is a large country that is also a producer, could be a very large producer, and it is already. But I think the Europeans are just now starting to crack the code and come online and get in line with the way of most people in this country are thinking. And so if I look forward in a global sense, I would be looking to Europe. We're natural partners. We've been trading with those folks for a long time. And I think that's where, from a global standpoint, that I would like to concentrate on in the coming years, for sure.
Kellen.
Asia. I think that, and it might just be because I saw some headlines this morning about Japan kind of firing up their medical program.
Okay. But
I like thought about it a little more, and I was like, you know, China's got second largest economy, maybe first. You can make some arguments either way. A lot of really smart people there, a lot of big tech culture there. You got the Golden Triangle as well. So like a lot of drugs and cannabis and narcotics have been coming out of Southeast Asia for a really long time and supplying the globe as well, almost like our Emerald Triangle, if you will. And there's going to be a lot of middle-aged people that made really good money in the tech industry that have disposable income. And I think that it's a natural fit to kind of help alleviate a lot of the stress that comes with running startups and working in these like high stress environments. I think cannabis is a perfect fit for that. And I think that the populations in those areas are ripe for participating in a nice stress reliever. What do you think, Brian?
Barry, do you want to comment?
My only thought on that was the government in China is very difficult government.
Yeah, to, agreed.
As far as the people go and what they'll let you do and not do. I mean, speaking of being oppressive, but I think the rest of Asia, yeah, is wide open as well. It's I think it's the whole world is really under a cannabis watch, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be happening. I agree with you that the Asia does have a lot of those things in place. Japan, you can imagine Tokyo's alone is 20 million people. And so when you speak of Japan, now I think that's a much more a bigger possibility or sooner possibility than China would be. So, I think that we're wide open.
I think I'm surprised that none of you guys took some of the easy, obvious ones. But for me, I'm going to take Jamaica. I think with the history and the culture there, I think that it could only grow and the experiences can be wider and people can get a more inclusive, different opportunity in Jamaica than they probably get here in America. And I think given its proximity to some of the other places we spoke about, I think it leverages with the climate. It could be a exploding opportunity for the industry just to really grow there.
Well, I think you're right. And it already is kind of pseudo that way. I mean, you can go there and it's everywhere. And they're fairly loose on how you're able to consume. But I agree. And it's very close. And it has a history of cannabis as well. And I think you're right. I did kind of, because it's a little bit smaller of an island, but it has a rich history of the cannabis. We love going there in the early days. So, I have some great memories of Jamaica.
Yeah, I think we all do. So Barry, for our listeners, they want to get in touch. They want to buy Gentleman Smugglers products. Where can they find you?
Bass, go on our website. We have a locator. We're here in Massachusetts right now, soon to be in New Mexico. Hopefully it's on our website, gentlemansmugglers.com. Go take a look, try us out. So far, we've really been we've been happy with the responses we've gotten from our consumers. I constantly hear it when I'm on the road. I do these little mini tours, and we're close to 60 dispensaries in Massachusetts. So there's one near you.
Awesome. We'll link it all in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was fun.
Hey, man, I enjoyed it. It was good seeing y'all. Nice meeting you, and I hope to see you in person.
Likewise. Yes, sir.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Cannabis Health Radio is a podcast about stories from people around the world who have used cannabis to deal with serious ailments, many of them life-threatening. My name is Ian Jessup. My co-host Corey Yelland is no stranger to the devastating emotional impact faced by so many people receiving a death sentence diagnosis from a doctor. Told she only had months to live with anal canal cancer, Corey researched and immediately began using cannabis oil to eliminate her cancer and has been cancer-free for more than a decade. She told herself that if it worked, she would spend the rest of her life helping others, which she does tirelessly every day. When you listen to our podcast, you'll hear many stories like Corey's, along with others who have used cannabis oil for many more ailments besides cancer, such as chronic pain, PTSD, MS, and many, many more. As one of our guests said, "Your podcast gave me the confidence to save my own life." We regularly get messages from listeners who have heard our podcast and use cannabis to solve a serious health issue of their own or that of a loved one. We hope you listen to these stories and be as inspired and moved as we are with each and every episode.